Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. And back with us to talk about this is Julie Palmer. Julie is Executive Director and Founder of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. Julie, great to have you back.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here again.
Well, there's a lot to talk about in this issue. We had a great conversation earlier on What's Next about this when we first met. But it's a great opportunity, though, because of the month being set aside, just the idea that there is a month that is being set aside to bring some awareness to this issue. I guess in a lot of ways it speaks volumes about the need to
Absolutely.
Have more attention to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month, and every year since 2010, the president has dedicated the month to raise awareness about human trafficking and to educate the public about how to identify and prevent this crime. And so it's really important that as an agency, we continue to do that work and further the effort and acknowledge this month and engage the community further in it. And really the goal is to bring together all the entities, whether it's law enforcement, government organizations, prosecution, non-government organizations, nonprofits, that we can collaboratively further this effort in addressing this topic.
You know, before we went on the air, we talked about some of the confusion that comes around this issue, and there's a lot to it. We can get into some of those. So let's just start with a basic definition of what finally means human trafficking.
Absolutely. So in the year 2000, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was established, and the goal of that was that they would better serve victims and better prosecute perpetrators. And so legislation every year continues to be developed and further. And so when we look at how does that legislation define human trafficking, how in the eyes of the law do we know when someone is being victimized, is including both labor and sex trafficking. And so what that means is it's the recruiting, harboring, or transporting a person solely for the purpose of exploiting them, either through commercial sex or forced labor. So that can mean recruitment of any means. Maybe it's a device, social media, the internet, it's a vulnerability, they need a place to stay, there's a substance use issue, whatever means they're using to engage. And then harboring doesn't have to mean kidnapping. It can really actually mean they're taken to a site, a location to be forced into labor or forced into commercial sex, and they got to do those things at that site. And then the harboring, transporting. So we can take a person and transport them to locations. And often people think, oh, we're near the border, so there's a lot of people coming in and out of the Canadian border, or they have to cross international. And that's actually not true. For them to be a victim, it can be right in our own communities. I mean, we had a minor tell us that she was just taken to houses in suburbs and that she was asked to do things and that someone would stand outside the door with a weapon. And so this was in neighborhoods. We are getting victims brought to us through law enforcement that are in our suburban communities. A lot of our affluent areas that we would not anticipate this happening. We had an individual reach out to us because she heard one of our education trainings and identified it in her own neighborhood. And so ended up making a call, was investigated, come to find out there were several people being brought in from foreign countries to be forced into commercial sex acts. And so this is happening all around us in all different ways. And I think part of the issue and part of the reason this month exists, as well as Human Trafficking Awareness Day, which is January 11th, is to help educate the community. And not just the everyday community member, but the people in various professions who may encounter these individuals to understand. And so when we get an individual in that situation, it's really important to look for force, fraud, or coercion.
Okay.
That's when the law considers it a crime. So we may get an individual and it may present as if they were maybe choosing to be out engaging in sex acts or in this work setting doing this work. But then when you dig deeper and ask more questions, there might have been a threat to their family members. There could have been violence that was brought upon them to keep them compliant. We've had individual clients who have been beaten, who've been stabbed, who've been punched, who've been raped. I mean, just so many things that they'll do. And then fraud. We have several stories of individuals saying they're promised a job. They come up here thinking they're working in massage parlors, and then they get asked to do other things, thinking they're coming in. We had one client tell us about hotels. She was brought in from state to state. They were moving her around different states, asking her to work in these hotels, you know, wasn't documented, asking her to do all these things, not paying her what she's supposed to be paid, telling her if she doesn't do what they tell her, they're going to have her deported, they're going to take away her housing situation. So it's just a manipulation of people fraudulently. And then coercion. And this is a big piece because we see this a lot, especially with people that have a lot of vulnerability going on in their lives. Maybe they're a minor who is unhappy at home. Maybe it's somebody who's struggling with substance use. Maybe it's somebody who's struggling with homelessness. Individuals that are foreign born may not know the language. People that are going through traumas, don't have good family support. We see an increased risk with LGBTQ populations. You know, just seeing how this is impacting people in their scenarios, and then people will coerce them. Hey, if you stay with us, we'll take care of you. Hey, you need that substance? Will you do this? I'll give you this. You need a place to stay? You do this, I'll give you this. So it's a lot of give and take and coerciveness when people are in especially vulnerable positions.
You go to the PATH website and there's some really interesting information there and numbers, and numbers don't lie as they say, but one of the things that goes with it, a statement that says the global impact of enslaving human beings is more than any time in history.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable to think about, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So it's double the African slave trade in its entirety. Right now, it's an estimated 27 million people around the globe are being impacted by what's called modern day slavery or human trafficking.
I want to ask the question why. And as I say that, of course, why? Well, it's profitable for
people. Absolutely.
At the same time, though, there are a lot of illegal activities that people could be conducting and perhaps don't because the risk is too high. Is the risk high enough for these people that are organizing this? What do you see?
Well, I don't think it would be as significant, right? I think that some of the factors is, one is individuals that are trafficking persons, they can reuse. Right. So if they're trafficking drugs, let's say drug and arm trafficking, right, weapons, substances, once they sell it, they got to replace it. If you have a human and you keep posting them, putting them out there, they can continually do that over and over and over and still have that same individual doing the same thing over and over. So there is some profitability in that.
Right.
I also think we have a lot of vulnerability around the world still. You know, we kind of think we're progressive, and then in some ways we're not. I think the devices, the internet, while certainly a lot of good has come from that, and it's advanced society in amazing ways, with everything, people find misuse and criminal activity. And I think because almost every child has it in their hand and are on it, and there's so many easy ways to engage, that's where I think we're seeing a huge leap in opportunity for people that have criminal intent.
There's a lot of approaches or a lot of elements to the internet that we could probably focus on, but one that you brought to my attention is gaming. These online games that, for me, it seems like something that it is almost make-believe, but I'm as a generational thing. For younger people, it's very much a part of who they are to be on these games.
Absolutely.
Where they're interconnected with people from all over the world. This is being seen as a place where people are recruited.
Absolutely. And just to your point, you can talk to anybody in the world, right? So what prevents me from having a conversation with a 13-year-old and saying that I'm 13 and, hey, let's hang out, or what are your interests? Getting them to share information, where they live, where they go to school, what they do, and then it just starts the manipulation. I mean, that's what makes it such an easy platform, right? And then there's gaming, Discord. It's a very interesting platform. Honestly, I did a huge training on it. I still feel like I'm learning, but it's a combination of like creating gamings and chat features and letting people in and out of platforms and rooms and engagement. And it's very anonymous. And the platform intentionally makes it anonymous. So there's individuals that are, when I did an FBI training, they were saying there's perpetrators that will put themselves in third world or other nations where we have no jurisdiction. They will start going on these games, soliciting explicit photos, videos, et cetera. And then they will blackmail and tell these kids, hey, if you don't send me $200, I'm going to expose all of this. And so then they're in a place where we have no jurisdiction to address it at all. So there's just all these barriers. We're hearing in some of the trainings I've been to, the platforms, your social media platforms, we don't think about when we post something, right? We delete it and we think we deleted it. Well, they're servers. Right. So you didn't delete it from the platform that you're using. You didn't delete it from their server. And so there was cases where one of the social media platforms, an individual had like over 300 explicit photos, videos of hundreds of people. They went to try and do a case and the platform's like, well, you need a warrant. This is our property.
Mm.
You know, and think about that. Right. They're right, in essence, not right. That it's a good thing. But so I think in society, we're just not even realizing. I don't think people are ignorant. I honestly just think we don't realize, right? My husband's an educator, and he says all the time, these are things we don't even know to know.
Right.
You know, until you come into the schools and bring it to our attention, it's just not even something we realized we needed to know. And so I think that's part of it. I think society, by and large, the professional fields are very cognizant, but it's just you didn't know you needed to know. And so we do a lot of work in those areas of like, if you give a kid a Chromebook, if they have a phone, if they're on social media, what is actually going on? And what are the risks and things to consider? What are things parents could be doing more intentionally, right? I say to my friends, I'll ask, what are your kids' phone rules? We shut them off. There's a lot of parental controls. They don't go to their bed with the phone. I mean, it's like going to bed with a stranger, right, in essence. And so, I think there's just things we can do to be smart. Does it mean we can stop everything? Of course not. But I think when your kids know and people you care about know, hey, this is something we need to be more cautious of, we need to have conversations about, that's one more step toward prevention.
Julie Palmer is with us from People Against Trafficking Humans. It is January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. We've talked about some of the numbers, and they really are overwhelming in some ways. 27 million people across the globe. And even here in your agency, you've served over, 1,000 victims, right?
We have served over 1,000 victims since 2015. We're really excited that 2025 is our 10th year of providing services. So stay tuned. This summer we'll have an anniversary event that we're real excited about. But yeah, it's an unfortunate number to have.
How did you founded PATH? How did you get involved in this initially?
So People Against Trafficking Humans originally started as a coalition through a church. And so they were doing a lot of awareness and just kind of getting more of the faith community engagement. And my background was behavioral mental health, took a little break as a mom of four. And I heard the woman who is kind of doing this coalition present. And it just, I was completely shocked that I have a degree from UB doing behavioral mental health. How did I not know this?
Right.
And so just hearing the stories, hearing her describe it, it just really broke my heart. And just being a person of faith, I really felt like it was a leading that was being put in my heart by God, and just to follow through with that. And so in 2012, she didn't really have time to put into it, and kind of asked the group of people that showed up to a meeting, hey, is anyone feeling led to get more involved? And so that was kind of my moment of, okay, is this the door to walk in? And so May of 2012, I did. And then we formalized as a nonprofit and opened our enrichment center in 2015. And so we've been able to provide services and do more work beyond the education awareness. We also do prevention and restoration services.
It's interesting how you described hearing about this and the question you kind of asked yourself. You have a background of sorts that would somewhat, you know, encompass this to a certain extent, but yet you didn't know anything about it.
Exactly.
Has that informed your work as you move forward that, you know, here's a person who probably should have known or easily could have known, didn't, and how you've gone about maybe, you know, establishing what you're doing at PATH?
Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely. I mean, our education arm is exploding. I actually recently promoted one of my staff to be doing our outreach because we get so many requests for presentations that it's not something I can keep up with, which is a great problem to have. I mean, we're not at the point, we're not even soliciting anymore. The word is just getting out. And, you know, this month alone, we're in dozens of school districts presenting. This month got asked to speak to 6 different agencies, a lot of them in behavioral mental health or in the medical field. And I think there is this, I think there is becoming a more information getting out there where agencies are like, wait a minute, we're probably coming across this and the people we serve and have no idea. So I think it's a great thing that's happening right now that people are like, hey, wait, we need to know more. And I think it's I'm so thrilled that people are reaching out and saying, hey, we want to train our staff and know more. Also have an opportunity to present in the court system with Judge Pridgen, who presides over the Human Trafficking Intervention Court in the city of Buffalo this month. So several church communities have invited us. So it's really great to see that people really want to understand it better. And so that's key.
And with the problem is so large, obviously, that it's going to take a long time to chisel away at this, mm-hmm. you know, one person at a time, right? But you've talked about jurisdiction, international jurisdiction is obviously a problem, mm-hmm. but what are some of the other, I guess, maybe not global, but, widespread issues that really need to be addressed that can really maybe try to help put this problem into its place?
It's a hard question because I think it's just pervasive right now.
But it's interesting, though, yeah. to say that there are these groups that are intrigued. There are enough that they're reaching out to you. Come tell us more about it. So that most certainly is an encouraging mm-hmm. sign.
Yeah. I think it's absolutely, with every system of society, there's always going to be things that benefit and things that don't, right? And so I think there's still barriers, systemic barriers that put people at more risk. And I think it's just continuing as a society to be willing to look at those and see what are things maybe we can do more in those specific areas. I think homelessness has become a rising issue. And I think we see a lot of need for individuals to have a safe place to rest, that if they can't get that through the system, they're going to unfortunately look to wherever they can. I would say if you asked me what my staff spend the most time on or what's the biggest issue, I would say it's housing. And then second to that would be substance use. And so I think it's, there's a lot of great organizations trying to address both those issues.
Absolutely.
In our community. And what I find amazing is there's still people that we can't place. We have a lot of great homeless shelters in Western New York. And I'm always shocked at how they're all full,
right?
You know, and lack of capacity. The other thing I think too is serving survivors of human trafficking is a very different thing. So for example, if you have a domestic violence shelter or a homeless shelter, what they've experienced tends to have different challenges that I think, as I've done a lot of my own education, talking to agencies across the country that serve residential facilities specific to survivors of human trafficking, there's different things to consider.
Okay.
And so I think that's something that needs to grow, not just in Western New York, but across the nation. There is still a huge need to develop and enhance residential facilities for people that are victimized. And so that's one of our big initiatives, is a housing initiative that we're looking at. And we have done a lot of conversations with agencies across the country as to what model is working. What is rehabilitating individuals?
You're seeing models that are working?
We are. Across the country, there are some that have been around for several decades, you know, and really it's been very interesting. It's really it's a long-term, very intentional programs, you know, where 12 to 18 to 24 months, where you're really getting intentional about not just resolving the trauma, which of course is priority, but domestic skills. How do you even live on your own, take care of your own needs, live in community with other people? How do you resolve conflict? How do they even go about thinking about how are they going to, you know, be sustainable on their own? What does that mean? Do they need to go back to school? Do they desire work? What does that look like? I think we as a society want people to hurry up and be better.
Right.
And this is not an issue where people go through that kind of trauma and hurry up and get better. And so I think it's a very intentional look at what is the structure of a residential facility that's going to allow for that.
And when you, I don't want to get into generalities when it comes to people who are victimized, but at the same time, you know, like you said, 18 to 24 months, perhaps, maybe mm-hmm. longer, to overcome these things. Take us as you can, when you, some of the people that you've experienced, mm-hmm. what you've seen from them, I guess I'm asking, how you can see maybe how they've been broken, if I can use mm-hmm. that term, or most certainly heavily impacted. Go through that a little bit for me and try to give me what you see.
I think the biggest thing that stands out to me is how much their self-worth and seeing themselves as valuable has been completely dismantled. And that's a work our staff does really well, but it's not something you can quantify, right? So funders, grants, they want to know numbers and data, which is very good to do. But I think a lot of the work with the people we serve is very relational and very intentional. It's been interesting for me as a clinician, because the model behavioral health is you have your, you know, individual sessions a few times a month. They may do a group or go to psychiatry, and that's the system. And what our enrichment center has done is created a space where people can come. We have three group days a week, so they can come all 3 days. They can see our social worker as much as they need. There's not a limit in care. And so because of that, I see relationships developing more quickly and the trust being built, because with any relationship, time is what builds.
Of course.
That. And so as I see that develop and people start to believe that there is a group of people who actually care, then I see some change. And it's been very interesting, because they come in not believing we'll be helpful a lot of the time, or that we'll care. And I get that, right? Because most of your life, you are someone's commodity. And so it takes work, and our team is willing to do it, and they do it really well. And I think that's really key. I think that's something we can miss in the clinical world or the systemic process, is at the end of the day, human beings need to feel like they belong and matter.
Well stated, that's for sure. And do you see that as being maybe even just, you know, you said about before, like societal issues, but you know, it's almost maybe, you know, it's hard to judge today from 100 years ago or whatever the case may be, but that there is that longing for mm-hmm. self-worth that maybe isn't being fulfilled in whatever reason. It's just adding to this problem?
Absolutely. I mean, perpetrators are very manipulative. And so if they see a person that doesn't seem to have that, they'll lead them to believe they're going to offer that to them. I mean, that's some of the lure. Hey, you don't have any friends. Hey, your parents are, you know, mistreating you. Hey, we'll care about you. Come hang with our crew. You can be part of our fam. I mean, that's a lot of the tactic. And so, again, that goes back to our awareness of, you know, one of the things some educators asked or my husband asked is, how can I know or pay more attention? I said, just notice the kids on the fringe. Even, you know, and as an educator, it's not their job to counsel kids.
Right.
You know, and I hear that and absolutely agree. But you can just pull them aside or look them in the eye and say, are you okay? How you doing today? I think sometimes that small thing, we have no idea, you know. And it was interesting because my husband was telling me a story a while back how he just noticed like the kid didn't seem, you know, the same, and just pulled aside, is everything okay? And the kid just burst into tears, you know. And of course, you know, he listened and then said, why don't we walk down and talk to the school counselor, you know, and made that link. But, you know, he was just very taken back by the effect of just asking the question and what that meant to the child. And I think that's part of humans, right? Like, we go through our day a lot in general. We don't stop. You know, if we notice somebody's off or we sense something, do we often ask? Sometimes we don't want to know, right? And so I think in this work that we're doing, we need to take time to know.
Julie Palmer with us here talking about National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Julie is the executive director and founder of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. You mentioned your enrichment center. What can you tell me about the enrichment center?
So our center is located in the city of Buffalo, and we provide survivor support services, addressing the whole person. Really, the model was to help resolve trauma physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So it was really restorative in nature. And so it's kind of a combination of intensive case management. A lot of the people we get referred have a lot of case management needs, resourcing, linking, housing, food. Maybe they needed an attorney, you know, just a lot of social services. So they do a lot of work in helping with that. And then we provide our therapeutic support services. So we have on site our 3 days a week of group supports. And then the other days of the week, there's all the individual support that we offer. In those groups, we have an art therapist, a music therapist. We have a trauma therapist. She does a trauma group. Our social workers run life skills, kind of anger management coping group. We have Well Health, which is 1 day a week. We have physicians on site to offer free health care needs, whether it's, you know, their health ailments, sexual health, substance use, mental health, and it's a bridge program. So if people get disconnected with providers, we help get them relinked. And then we had just completed a work readiness program in partnership with 716. They have a whole 12-week program, and our goal is to do it twice a year to really help people get ready for work if they're in that space where they're kind of ready to look at that. And it's a great course that really teaches them a lot of skill sets. They help them build a resume. They help them apply for jobs, a lot of mentoring support, how to handle workplace. So just really trying to offer a variety of opportunities, you know, and everybody resonates with different things. You know, some come in and they are only ready to meet with our social workers one-on-one, have maybe that case management, individual counseling support. Some come in and they don't want to talk, but they'll sit and do art therapy, you know. So we meet them where they're at. Some people, they just need a meal and find a safe space. We give out about 90 to 100 meals a week. To anybody that comes in our door, we have a clothing closet, so there's clothing access. You know, it's really meeting people where they're at in the moment that we serve them. One thing that I've really appreciated now that we are entering our 10th year is watching how some of our clients have been with us for 5, 6, 7, 8 years are developed and where they are today and the transformation of that, but also acknowledging it takes a long time.
Sure.
And you got to be steadfast and consistent with people to help them through that journey.
And how are people finding you? I mean,
yeah,
obviously outreach,
question.
But I mean, how,
yeah.
How,
combination of outreach, you know, through all these trainings and education, people are hearing about us, referring. But I would say a lot, we get law enforcement referrals, we get court referrals, we get other, you know, human service agency referrals, probation referrals, medical profession referrals, schools, you know, other people in the community that might hear about it. So really kind of a vast range of where people are hearing and giving us a call.
We're going to take a brief break here on What's Next and come back with more. Julie Palmer is with us from PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to What's Next with us, Julie Palmer from PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. And Julie, I'm going to put the difficult burden on you to help us go through this a little bit, because I think so much of what we talked about in the first part here is the fact that it's shocking how pervasive this issue really is. Mm. And at the same time, it's not something, because it is so pervasive, it could be anywhere and impact just about anybody, the best families or people who think they're the best families, the most affluent people. Mm-hmm. It can happen in a lot of places. So I want to just try to help, if you could, help us explore maybe some stories where, you know, these are examples of how this happens.
Sure. I think one thing that comes to mind with our youth population, we serve both teens and adults, is the number of runaways. And just how many of them end up caught up in this situation. I think I heard a statistic years ago by law enforcement that after running away like four times, they have like an 86% chance of being solicited. You know, like I said earlier, perpetrators are very savvy at looking at ways to manipulate people, right? And they're kind of paying attention. I mean, a runaway is a great target in the sense of nobody knows where they are, right? And so we see, and it's been interesting, like one that's coming to mind is this woman who kind of described herself as the auntie who would take care of them and bring them in her place and that you can stay. And then some of the stories our teens are telling us is like, but then there's boys being brought in and suddenly they're now their boyfriends doing these different things, you know. And as the more the story came out, you know, we kind of identified that there was a bit of, you know, exploitation going on and you know, start having those conversations with the youth of like, okay, well, let's talk through that. And what do you think is going on here? So I think the runaway issue is a big one. And we're sadly seeing that a lot, even after we may get access to providing services to some of those youth, whether it's through, you know, the court systems or however we access them, you know, they'll be home temporarily and then they'll take off again. And a lot of it is the perpetrators relentlessly will continue to pursue them, you know, to come back into the situation. There was a teen I remember that was coming way out in the suburbs, you know, probably a good 30 to 40 minute drive and ending up on Broadway and Bailey you know, doing different acts, and they had her very heavily addicted. And so that kind of continued to perpetuate. You know, we have adult clients, same stories, that they get very heavily addicted. We've had a client tell us that they were drugged and didn't even realize it, and that all of these individuals are brought in for sexual encounters. So I think there's just these activities going on. You know, it's been interesting too, the number of stories we're now hearing of residential home, you know, homes and residential communities where people are being brought in for escort servicing, and you know how community members were noticing, why is there cars in and out of that driveway all day long? Why does it seem like these girls never leave the house and are always there? And you know, just kind of noticing those little red flag, you know, seeing changes, you know, indicators that somebody, you know, minors, they stop going to school, their grades start to fall, you know, they're very obsessed with their social media or connecting with somebody. We've had stories where individuals were, we unfortunately had a minor who was recruited to New Jersey and they asked for all their ID. You know, that's another, if somebody confiscates your ID, you have no capacity for a bank account, a credit card, rent, a car. You know, so again, just these little things they do. We see a bit of minors dating people three times their age, you know, and so digging deeper as to what's going on there and trying to get a better understanding of that. A lot of control on giving them phones, controlling the phone use, you know, not speaking for themselves. We do have some clients where their quote boyfriend call us a lot and want to know information, you know, with which our answer is we can't answer any of that.
It's the so-called boyfriends are calling,
right,
looking for their
right.
Yeah.
You know, trying to find out what they're telling us, you know, and because of HIPAA, because of privacy, we just don't answer.
Of course.
Any of it.
Of course.
But it's interesting how they want, you know, a lot of that control, want to know what's going on, what's being said, what's not being said. Individuals that get expensive items. We have served a number of clients over the years who are well, their nails are well done, their clothing is high end. You know, again, it's some of the lure because these individuals otherwise would not be able to live that lifestyle. And so that's some of the lure these individuals will try to draw people in with.
Is there an issue also with the idea that perhaps, like you said, they're performing commercial sex acts, which is against the law. Is there an issue with making sure, trying to, I guess, separate that idea between somebody who's breaking the law and somebody who is being victimized?
Yeah, great question.
Yeah.
And it's something we come across every day in all of the partners we work with. I think this is a question everyone needs to spend more time, that we all can be doing more work to look into. But it's that force, fraud, or coercion piece, right? So an individual comes to us or gets in the system where the legislation defines it as a crime is if there is force, fraud, or coercion. And so that's what to start looking at. And it's just all how we hear the story being told and looking more for the signs of that. You know, force could be actual violence or threat of violence. Fraud is telling them they're going to do one thing and it's different after the fact. Coercion is taking anything that is a vulnerability and manipulating that to keep them engaged. And so I think as someone tells their story or we learn more and we can see evidence of one of those things coming out, then for our agency, it's very clear that there is victimization going on.
And I guess to that, then, it's worth noting or worth perhaps highlighting that when people view commercial sex acts, that there might be something considerably more to this issue.
Absolutely. There could be a lot more deeper. And often individuals in that situation are either going to be afraid to share their story because a lot of times the perpetrators will convince them they're the criminal, right? Because to your point, they're, quote, breaking a law. So there's fear of that. There's fear of law enforcement they instill. If they are foreign born, it's the fear of deportation. It's fear of how they could harm somebody in their life. There's a lot of reservation they're going to have to trust and share. And so that's going to make it even more difficult for people to share their story. There's also inconsistencies. I'll hear that a lot. Oh, well, their story keeps changing. So then there's this notion they're lying.
Okay.
And maybe they are. But I more wonder, and I think what's more common with trauma victims is either they've been scripted by their perpetrator and then they lose the script, or that fear causes them to just tell a different story because of the fear. And so I think those are the things we stop and try to assess, right? Stop and try to consider. And I think that's really key and important in working with these individuals, that you may not get all the answers right away. I thought one of the most fascinating statements a client made, I don't know why this stood out to me, but she was somebody who was brought out of commercial sex, and she met her staff, and she came, you know, I try to greet every client. I don't always know their story or know a lot, but I every day try to just say, especially if I notice a new person. And I just introduced myself, and she said, you know, I just want to say to you that I'm really grateful that you guys didn't force me to share my story today. And I don't know why that stood out to me, but I thought, wow, that's kind of profound, right? Because she said, I've been with a lot of organizations, and everyone wants me to sit down right away, and they want to fill out their form and tell the story, and your team just wanted to get to know me. And that's important. And that is true. We, you know, we do have an assessment, a screening, but I tell the team, you know, first and foremost, establish rapport. We don't have to have that all filled out day one. And so I think that's key. You know, that really struck me that this person, and so what comes with that mindset that you're asking me to tell a story, and maybe I don't want to tell you that story that way, so I'm going to just say it this way, you know?
Sure.
So it really made me think a lot about how much do we consider that when we're first encountering the people that we serve.
Wow. It's a fascinating look at how people try to, are finding resiliency and trying to move forward with their lives. Here in Western New York, the problem is just as pervasive as everywhere else, or is it a little different?
Yeah, I mean, to be really fair, you know, data, statistics, knowing what's going on is very subjective, right? So for one, it's only people who report it. It's only where it's identified. So there is a National Human Trafficking Hotline. They collect data. Anytime a person calls, an agency calls, law enforcement calls, they identify an individual, they collect that data and map it. So you can go on their website. The last time I looked at it, they had only updated through 2021, but maybe it's been further updated. But they'll put statistics of regions of most calls. I think there was like almost 52,000 contacts that year. Well, so here's the thing. That's just only who is identified and called. And to the point of there's probably a lot more identified that aren't calling, right? You know, I don't think my staff is calling that hotline every time they have a referral.
Right.
So our region definitely had a lot of cases when you look at that map. It could be a lot of reasons, too. You know, you look around, there's task forces. Our region has one. We're a part of it. So are those regions better identifying because they have a larger network of task force members looking for it versus maybe the Midwest? Maybe they don't have that. So it's hard to gauge that. I think based on what I hear, the stories of the people we serve and my own reading and understanding, it's pretty pervasive across our nation and across the globe. You don't, you know, if somebody's going to say, where's a safe place to live? Frankly, it's everywhere. And so I think, again, it just goes back to our knowledge and understanding. And I think it's important also to note that it's not just commercial sex, but forced labor. And we definitely are seeing quite a bit of that. In our region, there's been a lot more data collecting and looking into that. The government's putting a lot more of a push and funding toward that. And we are seeing that increase. And I think there's factors, right? When you bring a migrant community into the region, people are going to take advantage of that. You know, when you have individuals who don't know labor laws, people are going to take advantage of that. And again, there has to be that force, fraud, or coercion, right? So it can't just be, oh, I made them work 3 extra hours and violate a labor law. It has to be, they either felt a threat if they didn't do the job, coerciveness, like maybe they're providing their housing and they'll withdraw it if they don't stay, you know, coercing them that, you know, well, now you're from another, we'll have you deported. You know, I think it's looking at what are the factors keeping that person engaged. But we're seeing a lot also of that type of trafficking in our region.
We are talking with Julie Palmer from PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. She is the executive director and founder of the organization. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. We're going to take one more time out and come back with our final moments with Julie Palmer. This is What's Next on WBFO.
This is Jack Cruiser with the Scoreboard on WBFO. Listen during Morning Edition and All Things Considered each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the latest on pro matchups and college rivalries, as well as standout local athletes from Western New York and Southern Ontario. Want more? Listen to a longer version of The Scoreboard at WBFO.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And this is What's Next. With us, Julie Palmer this morning, executive director and founder of People Against Trafficking Humans. Before we went to break, you mentioned a Western New York task force when it comes to human trafficking. Yes. Let's talk about that a little bit. Who is involved in that task force?
Yeah, so that is a task force that's funded through the Office of Victims of Crime through the Department of Justice, and it includes the sheriff's office, and then the U.S. Attorney's Office, and then nonprofit agencies are involved, and we help co-facilitate one of the committees, the task force for the support survivor services piece. And so the goal of that is for law enforcement, the prosecution's office, and NGOs to work collaboratively. And I think the model in itself is a needed model.
You right.
know, we as an NGO are not in the business of taking out perpetrators or even going into dangerous situations. You know, sometimes we'll even get a call, you know, and we'll say, you know, we're not going to send a staff to that dangerous site, but we certainly have partners who will do that for you. So I think that collaborative model of law enforcement is out there. They're helping get people out of those situations. They're helping to bring in perpetrators. The prosecution's office is, you know, and also the Erie County DA's office is also trying some of the cases, you know, because we also need convictions to keep these people out of our community. And then we serve the individuals once they're referred to us for services. And there was actually a big case. It's been public with Peter Gervais and the FBI. And we were able to assist some of the victims in that situation. So I think, you know, it's that collaborative effort that made that a successful case.
So there are then these prosecutions, I guess does stand to reason that a victim would have to testify in that situation, which I can only assume, even going back to that earlier comment you made about, you know, this is the first time that somebody didn't ask me to tell me my story. But,
right.
You know, talk about, you know, trying to, it's again, resiliency and and courage. That's asking a lot out of somebody, though.
It's one of the biggest challenges. And from what I learn from, you know, the prosecution offices of law enforcement, one of the biggest needs to prosecuting is these testimonies, that a lot of the evidence, because of the nature of the crime, is hard to prove or get enough of what is needed. I'll often hear where they'll tell us they'll bring other charges. Like in this case I mentioned, I believe there was also drug trafficking charges. I believe there was some other like obstruction. Like there was multiple charges.
Yes.
And so I think that's part of it, is needing to see how many high-level felonies can be charged, because if individuals are not willing to testify, that leaves some holes in the success of the prosecution in these cases. And, you know, it's a challenging role as an NGO to be in, because we're obviously here in support of a survivor and to help in that journey. And if they're not feeling comfortable with that, we're certainly not going to force that. And there's a challenge, you know, because we understand the need. We understand how prosecution needs that, you know, and there's also a reality where a survivor may say, no way am I doing that, you
sure.
know, and so we have to work together in that scenario. But it is a challenge, and I feel for the prosecution and the law enforcement side, because, you know, there was a judicial process with legislation that determines conviction, and they're kind of bound in that,
right?
You know, and so there is that challenge. And I also understand why victims aren't feeling comfortable testifying, you know, so it's a challenge. It really is. That's why people say, why aren't there more prosecutions? Why aren't we taking down more of these people? Why this, why that? Because it's not just as simple as busting down doors and arresting, because they may arrest somebody, but there's also different things that need to be in place to hold them, to keep them detained, to get a trial. And that's the whole other side of it that I think as a community member, you wouldn't understand. And I certainly didn't until I got into this work, of all the nuance of that. And so that's why with some of these cases, like the call we had from one suburb, is it took, I believe, a month or two before arrests were made, because they needed to do due diligence and have enough to keep these guys detained and bring them to trial. And so I think that's a whole nother side of it. You know, that's a big challenge, and people are working hard to do, but it's not a simple process.
So let's use our final couple of minutes here, since this is Awareness Month, right, or Prevention Month, I should say. But some of the basic concepts that you want people to understand about the issue of human trafficking.
Absolutely. I think what I feel, you know, as a mom, as a leader of a human service agency, a community member, I really think it's just being more invested in people. You know, as a parent, being more invested in your kids, knowing what's going on with them, having conversations. You know, my kids say we're the strictest parents there are. I tell them we're not, because my law enforcement friends, they're much more stricter, because they know even more than
right,
I know.
Right.
You know, but, you know, some of that conversation is, okay, let's talk about that. You know, why do you think I have these concerns? Why do you think we do limit things? And then as they, like, think it through, they realize we're not just trying to be mean, strict parents, but, like, we care for their well-being. There's things out there that they may not always realize, you know, but they're very educated. You know, we have very real conversations at the dinner table. Honestly, the dinner table is a great time. We are a family that no matter what time it is, I mean, I have wide range of ages of kids, several teens in high school, and it's busy. We're all busy.
Sure.
But even if it means we eat at 8 o'clock at night, we sit down and eat at 8 o'clock at night, and we just have conversation, and they may share something going on at school or social media issues or what's going on. And so I think as a parent, I've had to learn not to be quick to jump on and be like, don't do that, or I can't believe that, but more wanting to know and ask questions. I think asking questions. I think when you hear of a training, we're going to be doing an online training at the end of the month. People can go on our website. And they'll see that coming soon. You know, we're speaking to about a dozen organizations this month alone, schools. I think people bringing us in to do education trainings is a really, wherever they work, they could be in businesses. It doesn't mean your business maybe you might, depending on your business encounter. But if not, as a community member, just having the knowledge where we can share, here's what to look for, here's what's going on. I think, you know, if you're in a school, if you're in a medical community, if you're in a church community, you know, human services, whatever you're doing, it's always going to benefit to learn more and educate the public. The more the public is educated, the more, and we're getting more and more tips, and a lot of them are real. And I think that's key. You know, and then we have our partners in the task force to say, hey, we got this tip. And then they get to go look into it. I think these are the key things where community might feel like, well, I can't do anything. Actually, some of these cases were because of the community finding them. And I think that's important for people to hear and know. And also important not to be afraid. You know, we can live in a society where we hear the news, we see everything. But also at the same time, there's still a lot of good going on in the world, and there's still people that care. I work with a lot of people who care, who work hard to fight this. And I think as a community, if we continue to work together, I think it's really key that we work together. I think people can put aside, we all can have our opinions. That's what makes America great. But I don't think that has to get in the way of our working together. And I think if that's a message I could share, you know, I work with a lot of government organizations and nonprofits and faith community, and we all have our own belief systems, our politics, but this is bipartisan. And I think this can, any person of any different faith can agree that we want to stop human trafficking. And I think that's what I'd ask the community to do, is join together with us and all agree that that's something we don't want to see in our neighborhoods.
Well stated, Julie. Thanks so very much. Julie Palmer is the executive director and founder of PATH, People Against Trafficking Humans. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Again, Julie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. And hey, hop onto our website, pathofwny.org. We have lots of opportunities to get involved, to volunteer, to, we have staff positions, to donate, to be a part of awareness. So I encourage people, can ask us to be a speaker, but I encourage you to go on there and check out what's going on.
This has been What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.